Ladies and gentlemen, if I could get your attention again, we'd like to get the program underway. Thank you all. I always hate to have to do that, but it's got to be done. We got to get moving here. I have a couple very quick announcements to make before we introduce Ed and start the program. We do have a membership drive underway. There are two promotions. Join BMA Chicago or renew your membership before June 1, and you're entered into a drawing to get a free pass to the national conference. And there's some information in the back on some of our other promotions. As we also have a raffle today, and I don't know if our raffle people have been around to the table, but the prize, if you do buy a raffle ticket today, is a Bluetooth headset courtesy of Suzanne Martin and Motorola. So that is the prize today. You know, we've had some pretty nice prizes for the raffles in the past. So if you haven't bought your ticket, I think you might still have a little time to do it. We'll do the drawing at the end of the program and ask Ed if he doesn't mind to pick the winner. Well, there's an interesting discussion underway on the BMA Chicago LinkedIn group, which now has, by the way, more than 1,100 members, on the subject of the importance today of building awareness for yourself and building a brand for yourself during a recession, with about 3/4 of the people saying you need to keep doing it, but about 1/4 of the people saying no, you probably should put that money elsewhere. Today's speaker is a man who has had no qualms over the past 8 years in investing in what I like to call market familiarity. These investments have done wonders for his company, Grant Thornton, and he can prove it, and he's going to tell you how he and his colleagues did it. Just for the record, Ed is a partner and the chief marketing and sales officer for Grant Thornton, LLP. He's responsible for strategic marketing, brand building, and managing the marketing and sales resources of the U.S. member firm of Grant Thornton International. Since 2001, net revenue at Grant Thornton in the U.S. has increased from $359 million to more than $1 billion. Russ, Ed has won the CPA Marketing Forum's Accounting Marketer of the Year. That was in 2005. He joined Grant Thornton in 2001, interesting time to join any company, and he had been National Director of Marketing for PricewaterhouseCoopers' $400 million middle market practice. 7 years before that, he was Director of Marketing for a global valuation services firm. And I learned this about him: when he's not working, and you need to know this about him, when he's not working, Ed is a high-speed driving instructor, and he races a vintage Porsche at Road America. So let's give a warm welcome to Ed Russ.
Thank you, Gary. Let me ask a question. Before you got the invitation for today's luncheon, how many of you had ever heard of Grant Thornton before? Would you tell my CEO, please? That's great. Good news. That probably represents our brand familiarity numbers that we track. Before we get started with some of the strategy that we use to build the brand at Grant Thornton, I wanted to just give you some background to put it in context. As Gary said, we are the U.S. member firm of Grant Thornton International, one of the Global Six accounting organizations, and we provide audit, tax, and advisory services, consulting services, to young entrepreneurial companies, as well as companies as large as the Fortune 100. The people that buy those kinds of services tend to be CFOs, business owners, boards of directors, tax directors, other C-level executives in the company. It really all starts with marketing strategy, and I've got my advertising agency here, and they are insistent about defining what it is our strategy ought to be and work from there to the actual tactics. And as my right-hand man Randy will know, I get off the train every morning at 7:30 and I walk to the office and I'm thinking about one of three things. I'm either thinking about how I can build brand awareness for Grant Thornton, I'm thinking about how we can generate leads for new business for Grant Thornton, and I'm thinking about what ways can our people use, employ, develop to help our partners and our business development executives, our salespeople, close new business. So it's one of these three things, and we use these three elements of our marketing strategy to actually set the performance objectives of our 150 marketing people and three dozen salespeople throughout the country. So that's kind of all you need to know about what we're about. Let's talk about what a brand is. And I like this definition, and we could probably spend the entire half hour today, or we could probably spend a week talking about what a brand is. And for my purposes, I really like Jeff Bezos's definition of a brand. He said that ultimately a brand is the things that people say about you when you're not there. And the reason why I like that is because as a marketer, what I can do is find out what our target market thinks about our firm and figure out exactly what I want to think about our firm. And then my job is just to get us from point A to point B. And that's kind of all there is to building a brand. There's a lot of steps in between there, but that's the basic theory. What we want people to think about Grant Thornton when we're not there is that we provide personalized service and superior client service. And since so many of our clients have operations in other countries, we want to make sure that they understand that we have resources that we can access in 110 countries around the world. And the third thing I want them to think about is the notion that when you're working with a service provider, you really kind of want to have somebody who likes what they do. Because the implication is that if they love what they do, they're going to do a good job for you. And this isn't just true in accounting marketing. It's not just true in Granger's business, for example. This is true in any business, in any profession. I'd sure rather have a surgeon that loves what they do than one that would rather be on the golf course. And so we introduced the mnemonic device of a rose to be associated with Grant Thornton and connote the fact that Grant Thornton has people who love what they do. It's a shorthand for client service. We had a real problem in 2001. And I was with a firm that was considering buying Grant Thornton, and we did some research, and we asked CEOs and CFOs, if you're in the market for an accounting firm, which firms would first come to mind? And 70% of the people that answered that question said Arthur Andersen. It's not what I wanted to hear. 5% said Grant Thornton. And the other 37 to 41% or 45% said the larger competitors that we have now, and those firms BDO and RSM, who were then slightly larger than Grant Thornton at the time, had just about the same awareness levels that we did. And there's really no difference between 5% and 3% and 2%. It's just kind of the numbers. There's a range of error here, but it was pretty low. And so I figured, well, I'd done a number of startup companies before. I kind of knew the power of brand building. What my job ought to be is to first attack that 5% number. And so I've spent the last 7 or 8 years attacking that number. Gary mentioned this, and I didn't know Gary was going to mention this earlier, and he didn't know I was going to include this slide in my presentation. But this is typical of the sales call that we would go on in 2001. And we would contact the CFO if we got in at all, and he'd say to us, I don't know who you are. I don't know your company. I don't know your company's product. I don't know what your company stands for. I don't know your company's record, and I don't know your company's reputation. Now, what was it you wanted to sell me? This is why brand awareness is so important before the sales call, because brand awareness is the first stage in the client's buying cycle. And I'm still kind of a traditionalist, and I really believe in this four-step process that a client has to go through before they're likely to buy from you. And the first stage is that development of awareness. Because awareness tends to breed familiarity, and that degree of familiarity tends to breed trust. And when you've got the trust in the brand, that gives you brand preference. And so if it's between you and somebody they haven't heard of, the person that gets that has the brand awareness is likely to get the appointment. If somebody has that trust level and they're debating between choosing company A and company B, the company with the trust gets the nod. So we think that's pretty important. I mean, there's a number of tools we use to develop brand familiarity, and it's the same tools that are available to everybody in this room. The second stage is to capture the attention of that client. That client suddenly gets interested in what it is you provide, what products you provide, what services you provide, and we try to do that by offering information of interest. In our case, maybe it's information about a new tax law, or maybe it's information about, maybe we do a survey of CEOs and we can provide them with information about how these CEOs are optimistic about the next 6 months in the economy. So we do a number of ways, we create a number of ways that we can create information of value and then offer it to capture the interest of prospective clients. In terms of creating desire, that's really when you get face-to-face with your client or your customer. That's when you're much closer to the customer and you have the opportunity to ask some intelligent questions, we hope, and you spend 20% of your time asking those questions and 80% of your time listening to the answers, because it's those answers when you get the client talking, you find out all these issues that they have. And during this stage in the buying process, the job is to ferret out those issues and tailor your particular company's products or solutions directly to the issues that client's facing or the motivations of that particular client. And the fourth stage is action. That's closing the sale. And what happens is, if you've provided enough information and enough differentiation and enough reasons to make that client buy now, the client is willing to buy now and willing to buy from you. So those are the four stages in the client buying cycle. And if you look at the first two stages, that's really, in my mind, is the purview of marketing. Marketing has an effect throughout the entire four stages of the cycle, but they really make the impact in the first half. And it's your sales resources, in our case, our partners and our salespeople, they're the ones that actually close the sale. And so it's this integration of marketing and sales across the contact points of the buying cycle that I think is so important. And so that's how marketing and sales work together. So these are the channels that we use, and these are the channels that you're probably using. Maybe you don't use all of them. Maybe you use some that I don't even have up here. And if you look, let's see if I can make this work. If you look at this one, PR. PR is terrific because you can reach a lot of prospects with PR. You can contact a ton of people. And PR is really nice because it's third-party credibility. And it's someone else saying good things about you or somebody else mentioning the name of your company in the press. And that's really powerful. And if you move down, whoops, I didn't mean to do that. If you move down from PR down here, you'll see that the cost per contact of PR is very, very inexpensive. The trouble is, if you look at that bottom scale, and I never remember which one's the x-axis or the right or the y-axis. Somebody here will know. The horizontal axis. If you look at the left hand of the horizontal axis, you can see that publicity, there's not a whole lot of personal interaction with publicity. It's very fleeting. It does a great job, but it doesn't do everything. And so now let's go to the far right, where it says sales calls. Costs us between $1,000 to $1,500 to $2,000 for a partner to make a sales call. And there's some travel involved, they've got to kind of prepare. Hopefully they don't prepare in the car on the way over, but we know they do. But the degree of personal interaction is really tight in the sales call. It's great. The trouble is, it's expensive, and if you go along this axis, you can see that there just aren't enough hours in the day, days in the week, weeks in the year for your salespeople, the people that you're selling resources, whoever they are in your company, there's just not enough time for them to see enough people to fill that pipeline. So the idea is to kind of orchestrate these channels and balance the cost per contact across the client buying cycle and utilize all of them. And your job as marketing people is to figure out how to invest in each of these channels and balance that investment and integrate your message across those channels so you're producing a similar message no matter what the channel is and optimizing the cost per contact. All right, that's the theory. So we started out in 2002 and this was our first ad and we focused on client service and we focused it on one segment of the corporate population, that segment that was being served by a certain group of firms, will go unnamed at the moment. And we advertised in CFO Magazine and in Financial Executives Magazine because our chief decision maker was the chief financial officer. We also went into Business Week because they cover the chief financial officer, they cover the CEO who we wanted to reach. And by the way, they also were very, it's a very widespread circulation, and so they covered all the people that influence those decision makers, and they reached all the people that we wanted to hire, because one of our biggest problems back then is just hiring enough people. So we wanted to create brand awareness among our experienced hires and our campus recruits, in addition to the chief financial officers of our target companies. So we led with the headline, "Will the service you get from your accounting firm miss the mark?" And this really, I'm not going to read the copy from this one, but this really hit a pain point among the people we were trying to reach. And we used this as kind of an umbrella campaign. And in addition to that, we used something that we called Project Jumpstart, which was nothing more than direct marketing. It's the standard sending out a letter and following it up with a phone call to jumpstart relationships with new clients. And we sent out a lot of letters, and we made a lot of phone calls, and we got about 2,200 appointments out of it, and we brought in about 600 new clients, and we sold about $38 million worth of new business in that period of time, using this as the way to actually set the appointments under the umbrella of the brand awareness campaign that we were running. And you'll see our average win went from 46,000 to 97,000. And I'd like to say that was because we were smart, but in fact, we were just really lucky. Because that was when Anderson had collapsed and 10,000 Anderson clients had to find a new home. And fortunately, we were able to pick up a lot of them, a lot of those clients. It was also when Sarbanes-Oxley legislation was passed and there was a shortage of accountants and there's a lot of business to be had. So the third reason was that we wound up picking up 600 Anderson people, 60 Anderson partners and 600 Anderson people. And since then, every single month, we've brought in new partners and staff from PricewaterhouseCoopers, Deloitte, Ernst & Young, and KPMG every single month. And that gives us the resources who are used to serving larger clients so that we have the credibility to go after and the ability to serve those clients properly. And so we measured awareness again, and lo and behold, in 2003 it went from 5% to 12%, and our revenues jumped from $340 million to $459 million. So we said, that's pretty good. That's not bad. So what do we do for an encore? Well, we decided if we're in a people business, we're in the service business, and if our key point of differentiation is supposed to be superior client service, I really wanted to make sure that it wasn't an empty promise. And so we launched a client satisfaction measurement program, a client loyalty measurement program. And we surveyed the clients that comprised 85% of our revenue. So it wasn't all the clients, but it got the important ones. And we reviewed the results, and we went back and talked to the client. At least we hope we went back and talked to the client. And we asked them, what did we do right to get that high score, or how could we improve our score? And then the following year, we embedded that feedback into how we served the clients for the next annual cycle. And so it became a virtuous cycle. And after a period of time, we really developed a lot of client loyalty. And I don't know, are you familiar with Fred Reichheld's The Ultimate Question? He was a speaker here, what, Gary, a couple years ago? I really believe, if you haven't read this book and you're all interested in client satisfaction, get the book, go to his website. It's really good stuff. And he defines a concept called the Net Promoter Score. So if you're using a scale of 0 to 10, he says, well, take the percentage of people that give you a 9 and 10, and subtract from that percentage the number of people that give you 0 through 6, and that's your net promoters. And if you go to his website, you'll see that he defines net promoter stars at those companies that exceed 48%. So we were doing pretty well in 2003 and 2004, and so that gave me the confidence to continue on focusing on client service, because then we knew we were really approaching world class in terms of the level of client service. And so we did it again in terms of focusing on client service. And this ad says, there's a select group of individuals who have a passion for accounting. Yes, accounting. And that group happens to be the accountants at Grant Thornton. Our passion for what we do for our clients, our expertise and partner involvement has made us one of the largest organizations in the world. There are member firms in 110 countries. Give our CEO, Ed Nussbaum, a call with a phone number. Contact our partners at grantthornton.com. Find out how it feels to work with people who love what they do. This campaign was enormously successful, and our agency is here, CCFC, who did the visual and did the copy, and they really nailed it for us, because we did Harvey research on the ads that actually appeared in CFO magazine, and the people that read the ad, first of all, we won some awards because we scored so high on it in terms of readership, but the other thing was, the really interesting thing I found was the verbatims we got back from the readers were feeding us back word for word exactly what we wanted people to think of Grant Thornton. So this really worked pretty nicely, and we used that same copy, that same basic copy theme in radio, but we couldn't afford a lot of radio, so we just tested it in 6 markets with that same copy that I just read to you, or very similar copy, the same concept. And we got lots of nice things that a competitor said about us, who said it was really irritating, and our partner in Charlotte said they were running. We got a lot of nice anecdotal feedback. We couldn't afford to actually measure the result in every single city, but this was enough for us to go back to Grant Thornton leadership and say, okay, we got this anecdotal feedback. It looks like radio is a good way to go. And the folks from GRP Media, who do all of our media buying, said, listen, you spent $350,000 on spot radio. If you spend $250,000 more, you can not just be in 6 markets, but you can be on drive time radio in 1,500 stations around the country. So that's what we did. And in addition to that, they said, after a year or so of network radio, they said, you know, if you think network radio is working for you, wait till you get into television. And so we created a television commercial that mirrored the same copy, the same type of copy, and the same creative approach as the print ad. And this is what it looks like. If you roll number one.
Any global accounting organization needs to keep a sharp eye on the financial environment. Listen carefully to your needs and goals, and think long and hard about your business. But what distinguishes the accountants at Grant Thornton is their passion for the business of accounting. Grant Thornton, a passion for the business of accounting.
Thank you. It's for you guys. Well, we measured our awareness after that. And lo and behold, by the time we're finished with the print, the radio, and television, it had jumped from 5% to 27%, and our revenue had moved from $340 million to $886 million. So we said, well, that's pretty good. What do we do for an encore? Well, we kind of just did more of the same. And I'd like to think it was something really creative and breakthrough, but it really wasn't. What we did is we said, this is a good thing. It's worked pretty well. We're not reaching as many people as we'd like. Let's expand the reach. Let's increase the frequency. Let's continue to do an integrated campaign with the same message across all the different marketing channels that you saw earlier. And we added online, because that was the right thing to do at that time. And we started increasing our level of PR, because we thought that was important too. And let me just say a word about PR. We did pretty much the standard stuff that you'd expect to do. We provided editors and reporters with information of value, survey information. We'd give them press releases on topics that we knew that particular publication was interested in. And we provide them with subject matter experts, and hopefully subject matter experts that would return their calls, because they're calling on a deadline, and if you don't call them back that day, you've lost your opportunity. So we did all that. But the second thing we did is we did something that some of the other accounting firms didn't do, and that's we said, gee, there's some accounting issues out there, and let's own those issues and take positions on those issues. And some of those positions, some of our own clients didn't like. But we took those positions anyway because in the spirit of accounting reform, in the spirit of Sarbanes-Oxley, we just thought that these positions were the right thing to do. And so we took those positions, and by doing the right thing and by being very vocal about that, the positions we were taking, we wound up getting a lot of publicity in all the right places. And so we were copied. Now you'll see in a minute where we were copied from, but we increased the number of publicity hits every single year using that approach. And we were copied in Business Week. We were mentioned in Harvard Business Review and MarketWatch, CNBC. Last Saturday morning, one of our tax partners was on Fox News for, I think, about a half an hour, I'm told. And that was the fourth straight Saturday in a row that he was invited to come back and answer tax questions on Fox News. And so we're getting interviewed by a lot of the right media, and we're getting mentioned in all the right media. So that's working pretty well. And online, we kind of do the same approach in terms of certain media that appeals to chief financial officers and business owners. And these are some of the sites that they go to get their accounting and business information. And we started out doing some general branding banner ads, but I kind of didn't like the way that, I didn't like the look and the feel. I mean, it was okay, but I got a feeling that we were entertaining ourselves and not our clients. And so what we do now is we use that medium as a response mechanism. So now our ads tend to be focused on a certain piece of information of value, either a survey results or some specific information about a tax regulation or an accounting regulation, something on IFRS, which is an arcane way of saying U.S. accounting standards got to blend with the rest of the world. And information like that is what we use online for. And so that seems to work pretty well. And we expanded our reach and our frequency. In we added The Economist last year. We've been in Business Week a lot, CFO Magazine a lot, and Corporate Board Member every single issue since 2003, because that gets at the decision maker of all public companies. And we've expanded our reach and frequency in broadcast. And we started out on CNBC, and that worked pretty well. And so we added PBS, we added Sunday morning news by going on ABC with George Snuffleupagus. And then CNN, we like CNN a lot too, and we went into CNN and CNN headline news and CNN airport news. And last year we also added on to all that Fox News. So we gradually kept increasing our reach and frequency in our broadcasting. And then we took a break about a year ago and we said, okay, remember how it was in 2001 when we said this is what we want our clients to think? What are they thinking about now? Where are our clients now after all this brand building? And so one of the things that we did was we added a question to this client survey that I talked about a few minutes ago. And it wasn't really devoted to client service. It was really the question is, what do you find distinctive about Grant Thornton? And remember, these people that are answering these questions are being served by our competitors as well as by us. So what we can infer from the answers is that these are the kinds of things that our clients find to be important, and by the way, that we happen to be delivering. And so this is really useful information. We got about, I don't know how many, I'll say 3,000 answers to this question last year. This was my train reading during the month of August. But I read every single one of them. I read every single one of the 3,000 comments. And so I kind of was able to internalize what the clients were thinking in their words. This is something like a quantitative survey can't do for quite as well. And in addition to that, I retained the services of a company who does win-loss research. And so what they do is we feed them our wins and our losses every single month, our big ones, and they interview the decision maker, and they construct the answers to reflect what the client is looking for in terms of firm criteria and what the client's looking for in terms of what attributes are important to them in terms of serving them, knowledge and skill, responsiveness, communication. and what attributes are important to them with respect to the performance of the pursuit team that's actually going after their business. And so we get these great results, and it tells us what's important to the client, and it tells us how well we're doing with respect to what's important to the client, and it also tells us how well we do relative to our competitors. And in some cases, we do better than our competitors. In other cases, they're performing us. And so now we can figure out how to adjust that message so we can take advantage of the weaker areas and continue to reinforce the areas where we have a competitive differentiation. So all that research is really, really helpful. And what it boiled down to for me was these four criteria for selection of the services that we buy. And responsiveness was right up there near the top. And this reflected some of the service they weren't getting from some of their service providers. And the idea that a company like ours can provide ideas and recommendations to help grow their business, to help manage their business, to help control their business, that was really important to them as well. They didn't just want a service provider to come in there and do just what's in the engagement letter. They wanted a little bit more. And they also wanted quick answers to technical questions. I mean, you call your cable company, and how long are you put on hold? You know, they wanted answers quickly. And what we found out was, particularly some of the larger companies, and you'd think the larger companies would really be served quite well, and in many cases they are. But one of the hot buttons for the CFO and for the audit committee chair was, we ask our accounting firm this technical question, and it goes into some black hole in New York, and 2 or 3 weeks later we get the response, and it's a take it or leave it answer, and we have no say in talking about the answer. And so the notion of these quick answers to technical questions is really, really important to a major segment of our target market. And the fourth thing we learned was that it wasn't coming through very clearly that Grant Thornton had access to resources all over the world. And since fully half of our clients have operations in other countries, it was really important for us to communicate to our target market that yes, Grant Thornton does have operations in 110 countries, and we can serve you no matter where your operations are. So we created a television commercial, four television commercials to address these four selection criteria. And this is one of the first.
When someone you count on is not responsive, bad things could happen. That's why Grant Thornton clients count on us to be responsive. With easy access to partners in the U.S. and through member firms worldwide, Grant Thornton. Find out what it's like to work with people who love what they do.
So that obviously addressed responsive service. And if you were clever enough to see the recommendations by Grant Thornton in the about a tenth of a second that was in there, it kind of tended to reinforce that notion. And we created another commercial to address the issue of the fact that some of the service providers really weren't answering the questions of their clients quickly.
Please hold. Your call is very important to us.
Does it seem like getting technical advice from your accounting firm can, well, take some time? Why not talk to Grant Thornton? Easy access to partners has made them one of the largest accounting firms in the country. Grant Thornton. Feel what it's like to work with people who love what they do.
So, what are the results from all this? Well, anecdotally, and I really believe a lot in anecdotal evidence because it's actually cheaper than a lot of surveys. and you can select what input you give to leadership. But I'm getting emails from employees, and I remember one from a receptionist in Los Angeles who sent me an email saying, I saw our commercial on CNN Monday night, and I was so proud to be an employee of Grant Thornton. If all the advertising did was make our employees feel proud of being with the firm, I mean, that's that's kind of enough for me. Fortunately, I did a little bit more than that, but that was really nice to hear. And we had a managing partner of our Wichita office who happens to serve a $100 billion multinational company. And he said, he wrote me a note and said, gee, I'm really glad we're continuing to advertise in this down economy. He said, that's really great. This is a time we can capture market share. And by the way, I saw the global ad, the global resources ad that was in The Economist. And I think that's exactly the right place to be because it serves to give the right message to the type of clients that I'm doing business with. So that was really nice to hear from some of the people that are with our company. Another partner said, we're getting calls from companies we never got calls from before. And we also get encouragement from clients. You know, we've had occasion where our engagement team has gone to the audit committee meeting, and it's a very somber meeting, and the board of directors are all there. But they had laid out roses for all of our people. Isn't that great? And one prospect we were going after, he was the former chairman of Procter & Gamble. So he kind of knows something about building a brand. And he told our CEO, he said, the reason why you're at this particular proposal opportunity is because I saw your advertising and it was delivering exactly the right message for me. And I encourage you to keep doing that. And it was really great because that was like a month before my performance review. So last year was a good year. And in terms of client loyalty, we continue to measure that. Our average promoter score is now up to 62%. And I'm really, really proud of that. Fred Reichheld says that net promoter score leaders outgrow their competitors by an average of 2.5 times. Now, I don't know whether that 2.5 times is right, but it certainly has helped our firm immensely. So we measured awareness again, and we've moved the needle from 12% in 2003 up 27 points to 39% in 2008. And we built our revenues from $367 million up to $1.2 billion last year, which is a compound annual growth rate of 20%, which will probably not continue in this economy, but it looks good right now. And what I've talked to you about here, it makes it sound like the brand is the only reason why all this happened. That would be misleading if you walked away with that notion, because it wasn't just the brand. It was, we have a CEO that really believes in funding brand building. We have a CEO that really believes in the overall firm strategy that was an excellent strategy when we wrote it in 2001, and we've maintained that strategy ever since then with very minor tweaks to reflect the marketplace. And so adherence to strategy is key. Consistency of the CEO's willingness to invest in the brand is key. And the most critical factor is the fact that our clients are being served, we think, as well or better than any other set of clients that are being served in the marketplace, because our people really do have a passion for the business of accounting and they really do love what they do. So Gary, with that, I'll turn it back to you. And
what an impressive journey, what an impressive venture, and to stick to that position for as long as you have and to continue to generate these kinds of results, just amazing.
Thank you.
We wish you continued success. We want to take some questions, and we have time for a number, and I really want to acknowledge as many people as I can in the audience, but I'd like to start with one, which is, in my experience, I don't see too many professional services firms who have a lead marketing person also in charge of sales. I also don't see sales as a term used very often. It tends to be business development. Did they have sales and marketing together when you joined? Was that something you asked about? And why sales and not business development?
Well, it's a good question. Sales and marketing were not together when I joined the firm. We talked about that. I talked to the CEO when he brought me in. And I said that I thought that it should be part of the same organization, because as you saw in the client buying cycle, sales and marketing have to work together to make the whole thing work. And so it just made sense to me to have the two under one umbrella. And why sales? Because business development is a euphemism. I'd rather, it's sales. That's what it is. And so that's, I call it sales.
Very interesting. Questions from the audience. We have several folks with microphones. We'd like to wait for you to ask the question before you get the microphone. Michael, go to Adam, number one. Go first.
Easy questions, please.
Adam Levy, everybody.
This should be easy.
Good.
Obviously, you've experienced significant business growth over the course of these programs, and you've obviously done a heck of a job. My question is, on an annual basis, just ballparking it, what kind of expenditures were you able to implement to make those, to see that positive correlation in terms of revenue growth?
When I joined the firm in May of 2001, and in June of 2001, I gave a presentation to the essentially the board of directors of Grant Thornton. And I actually showed that one slide with the sloping curve. I actually showed them that slide because I really loved that slide. And I said, this is my marketing plan. This is what I'm planning on doing. And they said, if you're thinking about advertising, just forget it, because we tried that once and it doesn't work. Now, I know none of you have ever heard that before. So I'm kind of not going to answer your question as directly as perhaps you'd like, but what we did is we started out small. And we said, okay, just for a few thousand dollars, we can be in CFO Magazine. And we were in CFO Magazine, and I tracked the results as carefully as I could through that Harvey research, and they played back the information saying, see, this is working. We're starting to get some results. And so the first year was maybe $500,000, and we've since grown to a multi-million-dollar budget by doing it in incremental steps along the way and convincing the leadership with numbers that it seems to be working.
Has there always been strong belief in that marketing is the cause? And at some point in the process, maybe midway through, was there ever any pushback saying, you know what, we're doing okay. We need to reallocate some of these funds elsewhere.
So far that hasn't happened. We had an annual partner meeting in 2002, and the CEO asked, at the time I think we had 300 partners, we have about almost 600 now, and we used a mechanized way of, an automated way of getting input from the partners, and they prioritized all the issues that Grant Thornton had, and the partners as a whole said building the brand is our number one priority. Since then, we've done some work building the brand, and it's become less of a priority, but not so much less that they're asking us to reallocate those dollars to something else.
Okay. Thank you, Ed. Michael Krause. Yep. Ed, great program. I mean, congratulations on a landmark program in professional services. I mean, my question for you is about a little bit about yourself, and I mean, you're a really unique marketer, and I wonder if you could talk about what it is about your background that enabled you to pull off this kind of a fact-based, comprehensive program where those partners all want to put the money in their pockets rather than fund it. You've been able to really pull this off, and you race cars as well. I mean, can you tell us about it? What is it about you that enabled this to happen?
I wish you'd given me this question before, Michael.
Well,
no. Yeah, I was involved with four startup companies. And so I know what it means to kind of bang your head against the wall and not being able to afford to do stuff and really having to give the investors in those companies good, solid reasons for doing what I wanted to do. And I did join this one venture-backed company with zero sales, and I was a seventh employee. And about 6 months after I joined them, they said, well, okay, you're not going to be vice president of marketing anymore. We're going to make you acting CEO, and I want you to go out and raise money because we can't make payroll in a couple of months. And it was like a bucket full of cold water, and I didn't know the first thing about raising venture capital. But I kind of figured out what the approach ought to be, and Randy, you and I talked about this once. I think what I try to do is to look at the world through the eyes of the person I'm talking to. So I tried looking at the world through the investment-making decision, the decision-maker, the venture capitalist. And when I'm dealing with the leadership at Grant Thornton, I try to look at things the way they look at it. And when you do that, some of the reasons you normally give for making decisions, you realize they don't care about that stuff. What they care about is this, this, and this. And if you don't deal with this, this, and this, you're lost. So I guess the answer is, maybe it's empathy, I don't know. But it's the idea of looking at the world through your client's eyes, looking at the world through your boss's eyes, looking at the world through your spouse's eyes. And that helps.
Very interesting. Before we go to Len, who's next, and we'll go there, just a couple quickies. Could you mention the name of the win-loss firm, outside firm that you use? I suspect people here would be curious. And give a little bit more of a shout-out to your agency.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, our agency is Coyle Counts, Ford & Cheney. Cheney, not Cheney. You want to make that distinction. CCFC, and they're located right here in Chicago. And they're a wonderful agency. And our media buying service, who are partners with CCFC, is GRP Media. Jennifer Lay and Guy Lay are here at the table over there, and they're absolutely fantastic, and we would not have been able to do this kind of success without them. And what was the other question?
The win-loss firm?
Oh yeah, win-loss firm is Primary Intelligence, and it's great. You know, you give them the name and they go after it and they give you the data.
Lynn Hazen.
Hi Ed. In your presentation, you've referred often to the success of Grant Thornton because of its impassioned, dedicated, superior talent. Can you tell me what Grant Thornton does to recruit outstanding talent that is different from your competitors?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's a particularly great question because I've got an answer for it. One of the things that the leadership of this firm does, starting with the CEO and the entire senior leadership team, they make it a point to maintain the culture of Grant Thornton pretty much the way it's been over the last 6 or 7 years. And that's really hard to do because half the people that work for Grant Thornton didn't work for Grant Thornton 2 years ago. They worked for some other firm. And so bringing in all these partners and managers and staff from PwC and Ernst & Young and Deloitte and KPMG, it's really easy to fall into the trap of having your culture get fragmented. But we've put a lot of resources behind maintaining that culture and communicating that cultural difference to potential recruits, and we've been able to maintain that balance accordingly. So I think that's probably the biggest reason.
Very good. Question over here.
Hi, I'm Beth Galanis. Lovely presentation. Would you address, please, the sales side of your role? Could you address that in a little bit more detail and how it's integrated with the marketing communications side?
Sure. Accounting organizations are really complicated organizations. They're matrices. We have between 30 and 40 salespeople, and it's there, and they work out of the individual offices in the U.S. And it's their job to network in the community, to uncover new sales opportunities, to generate leads, and to help the partners close new business by shepherding the sales process throughout that client buying cycle. And they work closely. It's really interesting. If I look at we call them business development executives. We ought to call them salespeople if I were following my own philosophy. But these business development executives work very, very closely, the good ones, with their marketing counterpart in the individual offices. And I can almost predict when I see a salesperson's numbers low, I can predict that they're not talking to the marketing person. And I've seen it time and time again. And it's when those two work really closely together, when the marketing person's helping to develop the leads, that the salesperson can go in and help the partners pursue and get to close, that's when it really, really works well. Did that answer your question?
Yes, it was a great question. Reminds me of a statement once made by Fairfax Cohn, the co-founder of Foote, Cohn & Belding, and he defined marketing as what you do when you can't go see somebody. Uh-huh. It's a great line. Other questions, folks? I see one in the way back.
As sort of a part two of that question, can you describe the contribution as you may or may not have measured it, of the sales force and the direct marketing initiatives to the revenue growth that you cited versus the branding? And I know it's not, you know, an either-or equation, but I'm curious to hear. It's been a branding story, but I'd like to know more about the contribution of sales and direct marketing to the revenue growth.
Mm-hmm. That's a question that accountants always ask. They say, how'd you get this customer? Was it from the salesperson, or was it from the advertising, or was it from the direct mail, or was it from the call you made, or was it from the seminar we had? And what I always tell them is, yes. Because when you saw in that curriculum, in that curve, we're contacting people in all those ways. We contact them through PR, we contact them through partner sales calls and seminars. And there's no way you can separate out why somebody, you know, what was the last thing that happened that got you that appointment. You just can't mathematically sort it out. Now, do we measure our response rates on direct mail? Absolutely we do. And can we take a look at who we got our first appointment with and see sales that happened afterwards? Yes, we can do that. Do we measure the revenues that business development executives, the salespeople, bring in? Absolutely. And each one of them is bringing in between $1 and $5 million worth of business every single year. And we track that pretty carefully. So we do that kind of tracking, but the right answer is all of the above.
Ed commented earlier on how much he likes anecdotal evidence, but we clearly know from his presentation that he relies on lots of data to guide where they go next. And Ed will remember this. About a year ago, I sent a survey to him and many other CMOs asking them to comment on how they measure marketing ROI. And the longest answer I got was from this gentleman. Number two was probably Phil Clement. You clearly believe in data and measurement, just as Phil does in his organization. Is that because you're in an accounting firm and they really believe in data, or did you bring that with you? How do they like a very data-oriented marketing
guy? They love numbers. Are you crazy? They love numbers. They're accountants, you know, and that's the way you convince them to do stuff. But it's no different if you're in some other kind of firm, if you're in a law firm, or if you're in distribution business. The people that are in charge love numbers. They're used to reporting to their boards of directors on the numbers. If they own their own business, they're looking at those numbers. And so numbers are really, really important. And it's so easy for marketers to get caught up in the concepts and the wonderful creative and stuff. But unless you kind of relate that to the numbers, it's pretty difficult to capture their intention and to gain their trust.
Great. We have a question right there. And then we'll go to this person right here, this woman. We can move the microphone over that way.
Hi,
we have
Tom.
About eight more minutes, so we still have time for more questions. Please go ahead.
Tom Stack. I wondered, in working with my PR clients, they're often more concerned in op-ed situations about who they're going to offend rather than who they're going to influence. Curious how, when you got into the op-eds, how you took what I assume is a fairly conservative organization and convinced them that this was a good idea.
You know what? That was really hard. That was really hard to do. We took a position, and I don't want to get technical here, but we took a position on expensing of stock options. And we said that companies ought to expense stock options. And it was a really controversial position because so many of our clients were high-tech companies. And we really wrestled with that one. And ultimately, it had to be the CEO's call. The CEO decided, you know what, it's worth taking the position because it's the right thing to do. And by the way, it'll probably get us some attention in the press. And no other accounting firm is taking that position. And we'll deal with the fallout later. But before we had to deal with the fallout, we made sure we had plenty of talking points so that our partners, when they got those questions from their clients, knew exactly what to say to them to help smooth over the situation. But it was a challenge, and it's a challenge anytime you take that kind of a position. It's a risk. It happened to be worthwhile in our area, but you notice I only listed about seven of those major positions. They're hard to find. The positions are hard to find, and they're hard to go out there and take on a very visible basis. So it's difficult to do, but I think it was worth it in those cases.
Question here?
Yes, thank you. I have a question specific to that first ad that you showed of the coffee pot. In the copy, you referenced the U.S. business survey of U.S. business leaders to call us for a copy, and I was curious what the content of that piece was to understand the strategy of why you offered that piece of collateral with that particular ad.
Yeah, we actually offered that in quite a few of our print ads, because I always like to have some sort of a direct response mechanism to any of our print ads, even though it's becoming more and more difficult over the years to get direct response from advertising. And that particular survey was one that I thought was done really, really well, where we'd go out and talk to a lot of CEOs primarily and get their take on what they thought the economy was going to do in the next 6 months. Is it going to get bigger? Is it going to shrink? What's going to happen? And are you going to raise prices in the next 6 months? And are you going to add heads? Are you going to increase your head count or decrease your head count or keep it the same? And are your profits going up or down over the next 6 months? So it was kind of a forward-looking piece from the peers of the people we were trying to sell. And so we thought that would be interesting information for business leaders to help them manage their businesses, to kind of get a picture of what their peers were thinking about in the future. And although we don't do the in-depth survey anymore, we do a business optimism index that covers those exact same questions on a quarterly basis. And we provide that information to our clients as well as to the press.
George Raffiti.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for your time today. You're obviously a big believer in getting customer data and integrating the right tactics to reach your audience, and very impressed with your use of public relations. My question has to do with the wide world of social media, and specifically what you're doing to monitor what's happening in that big world, and also how you're reacting and being proactive using social media tactics.
We're using, we're in Facebook, and a number of our people are involved with LinkedIn, and our HR, from a recruiting point of view, we're very, very active in social media. It just seems like CFOs aren't quite there yet, but they're getting dangerously close. and so we're starting to think about that, but in the interest of transparency, from a marketing point of view, we're kind of in our infancy in that area. Yes, we have things going on in YouTube. You know, our commercials are up there. We created a video for YouTube based upon the long wait commercial that you saw. We extended that because the actor did such a fantastic job of portraying somebody who's stuck on hold for hours and hours and hours. And so we made a three-minute video on that, because everybody can sympathize with that in the customer service business. So we're kind of sticking our toe in the water, George, but we've got a ways to go there. We need to do better in that area.
Well, wonderful. I wish we had more time, but it's 1:28 and we do need to wrap up. I wanted to, a lot of you recognized, I'm sure, the man in the chair ad. That's the famous McGraw-Hill ad. Guy's name was Gil. I've done some research into it, but in our next B-mail, we're going to include a link in that section where we have conference links to a PDF of the famous man in the chair ad that you can download in case you want to use it with your CEO as well. Ed, we thank you so much. This was just a terrific presentation. I can't thank you enough. Wish you continued success. And we have a token of appreciation for Ed before we do the drawing. And you can imagine this probably has something to do with Porsche. It's the art of engineering, the story of Porsche.
Oh, great. Well, thank you so much, Gary. Thank you.
That's yours?
That's mine.
Okay. Oh, the drawing.
We have a little tradition here.
I want to introduce Vesna Arshik, who is going to do the drawing for the Bluetooth headset that Suzanne Martin and Motorola has donated today.
And you do the drawing.
All righty.
The ticket number.
Ticket number 6, 2, 3, 8, 7, 7. 6, 2, 3, 8, 7, 7.
Do we have a winner?
Oh, it's me.
Oh.
No.
And we do. Mark Carnes. Mark, congratulations. We'll take care of arranging for the gift to get you. It's very cool. I saw one earlier.
Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. We'll see you on April 15th.
I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.